Okay, well, so let's see. We have 10 in the audience, of whom 6 haven't heard this already. So, and so that's better than half. And
you're going to make sense of it all for us who participate.
That's my goal, anyway. But you know, first I have to address one of the serious disputes that arose in this session, which is how you spell block. So I was debating, you know, what do I do here? This is sort of a compromise between C and K, but I decided, you know, the most appropriate spelling for us is this.
The last letter, and I can tell the wheel is as good. Did he really say Q?
All right, so it's unfortunate Katerina isn't here to get the thanks in person, but she did an enormous amount, as I'm sure I'll be noticed, taking notes, and as well as the actual direct scientific contributions, which were also considerable. And just you know, a brief list of the things we actually covered, which included both things that occur very rapidly, such as scouting and trigger level analysis. And I admit I never quite understood Atlas's definitions. So maybe at some point in this, the Atlas folks can tell me if there is a precise definition for. I mean, in CMS, I understand what scouting is. Trigger level analysis sort of got divided in conversation between scouting-like activities and LHCB online actual analysis activities, and I never quite figured out
what the difference between scouting and trigger-level analysis.
Well, the words were used in two different, were used ambiguously in the Atlas discussions. I wasn't figured out if you have a sharp definition between division between the two.
To me, trigger-level analysis means that you have written out trigger-level objects. Limited information from the event.
I mean, it's also what you do with them, because
LHCB, not what they're doing at trigger level in their future is producing plots, as opposed to producing four vectors which can still sort of be analyzed and calibrated offline. So there is this question of whether you're doing something, you're collecting information very rapidly, but then you still may process it before you really analyze it, versus really just doing the whole thing.
We don't do that.
And so I think trigger level analysis, as most Atlas people mean it, is the same as scouting. Yeah. But Katerina was sometimes using it to refer also to what LHCB is doing, and that's maybe part of the confusion. Anyway, I'm going to use it to refer to scouting-like activities. So I want to make sure that's all clear.
Just to further confuse things, though, because what scouting is as it's done in CMS, it has evolved a little bit, too.
Right.
So the original idea, which was just to write the four vectors out to literally scout the data,
right.
And you would never really write a paper based on but of course, the people who were the proponents after they got those four vectors wanted to use them for analysis. So.
And their intention was always, surely.
Well, maybe it depends who you ask. Maurizio probably did, yes. Certainly, the people who approved it,
and
I was one of, you know, that was not what we thought would happen.
You mean, and then if you saw something, you would go back. Lower.
Yes, right. The idea was we would have thought it was a protection insurance policy to if there was new physics that showed up, that we would be able to change the physics menu and give bandwidth to whatever we had now good justification for.
But to come back to that, you know, I mean, there's, you know, to take the opposite side, perhaps, is that, well, there's a sociological
wrong
effect. I think it's correct. There's a sociological aspect of if people won't work on it if there's no hope of ever getting it made public, right? And publications are the way to do that. And these are important things to do that can't be done potentially in any other way. So it's difficult to recruit people to do it if you say, well, okay, you can do it, but you can't show anybody that you ever did it. And then there's the sociological aspect, and then there's the other aspect of, you know, given the data set and what people have actually done with it, there's been considerable work to really try and understand this. And I think that and work continues to improve in our understanding of the differences between what's online and what's offline. And so I think that within the realm of believability, we've done a pretty good job of actually demonstrating that this is not just make believe at some level.
No, I think I don't disagree with any of that.
But in the words, the mislink trigger level analysis does not mean you do the analysis when you're online. It means you just do offline analysis by trigger objects.
With the one observation that at LHCb, at least, it may mean that. So in any case, I'll just use scouting/TLA as my catch-all for that. Then there's the things you do later, which are the data parking and delayed data stream, where you collect the data and you don't actually process it till a later time. And one of the interesting things that is new, as far as I understand, in 2015-16 is CMS combining these two things, where some scouting is just done as described, but some scouting, if there's enough information and the rate is low enough, is combined with parking. So that if something shows up in the scouting, you can actually go and look at that data. So this is an interesting interplay of these two things that is worth knowing about. We also talked about FTK, which is going to be one of Atlas's big advances. It's being commissioned now and will be hopefully fully operational in 2017. And about what one can do with pretty fast tracking in general. So some of the conversation was about Atlas only, and some of it was really also, what kinds of tricks could CMS also employ. We talked a little bit about triggers using substructure and analysis with clutter yesterday. Now, almost everybody is here for that. So I'll probably give that relatively short shrift because I think, that's just really rehashing what we did yesterday. I'll do it pretty quickly. We sort of floating through the room at all time are long-lived particles because, all these issues play there. And we have a whole block devoted to that, so as we do for substructure. So we didn't devote our time to that, but it appeared a number of times. And then we had this nice talk from Eder and from Chris on the Millikan experiment, which we didn't then subsequently really discuss because sort of a special purpose thing, we didn't really have much to say about it, but the question was asked, are there any other parasitic experiments we should be thinking about? All right, so just to remind you before getting into any specific areas, there were some generic discussions about miscellaneous triggers, very general, and I just wanted to point them out and remind you about them. So first of all, we had some discussion about trackless jets in many contexts. There is a question of whether, that means not literally trackless, but it means you've got a jet with no tracks above some PT threshold. And it's not clear these have been fully exploited. It's possible they could be useful in the presence of something else, like VBF jets. But there's a question of how they make sense in the context of a high pileup environment. So we didn't really get a clear feel in the room, I think, for what you can and can't do with these things. And I don't know if that's something we can discuss further in the long-lived particle block, because that is something relevant there. But maybe we can get a little more information, that is to say, not vague statements, but some real numbers or some available data or plots or something, so we can actually talk about this more sensibly. Another thing that came up again and again, obviously Higgs-related, is, but also, I guess, these days, also people like this for dark matter for various reasons, VBF triggering. VBF is a very generic thing, like lepton, but it's much harder. Nevertheless, there are some techniques for doing it inclusively. There are also some techniques for doing it semi-inclusively, where you do VBF plus something, hopefully pretty generic and fairly soft, so that you can catch a Higgs decaying in some way, either standard or non-standard, that's otherwise hard to find. And the question of whether you're better off doing a fully inclusive trigger and pushing it as hard as you can with as much bandwidth as you can versus doing a set of semi-exclusive triggers or something in between is still doesn't seem to be resolved among the experts. Maybe it's not resolvable, but that was certainly something that was discussed, although clearly, it was hard to make progress, again, without having some details. A third thing that came up is jets that are entirely made from photons, photon jets, some cluster of photons, which doesn't look like a photon, so it fails ECAL object because it's just too messy and there's no one sub-piece of it that's a hard enough photon to pass a trigger. But on the other hand, it's a strange enough jet that you could identify it, but it'll fail a jet PT cut in a standard trigger, so you need to have some object. And it's not clear how useful this object is, but probably it should be a trigger object, should be defined, at least so it's available and studied, so it could be useful. There's plenty of theories in which these sorts of things arise. So we didn't really discuss that in that much detail, but okay, and then I think one of the most interesting ideas that we discussed was a way for studying monojet events using photons, which turns out to be highly efficient as long as the background is blue. Chris Hill demonstrated this very effectively, and it got a lot of interest. I would say that all of us tried it out, and we were all very satisfied with the result. And for those of you who weren't there, we had a couple of whales swim by in the middle of the session. So that distracted us for a bit, but... Okay, so on to the serious stuff. So scouting. I've listed at the top what JP told us about scouting 2015. I hope I've got everything correct there. There's scouting using pure calorimeter jets with some HT cut. There's no parking of this information, of these data. So what you get is that's all you have. But then for a higher HT cut, significantly higher, there particle flow jets are available, and that data is parked. So you can imagine an interplay between these two subsamples. And then there's a separate scouting sample which involves dimuons. These events are done with particle flow and parked, correct? And slightly confusing because the level 3 muons have a PT muon threshold of 3 GeV, but their seeds have a higher PT threshold but of course a turn on there. So it's a little bit messy from a theorist's point of view to figure out what you would see and what you wouldn't. There's an invariant mass cut of 10 GeV to remove the epsilon. One could in principle go down lower because the resolution is good. But at the moment, that's not done.
So, question. So, why is this dimuon trigger particle flow? What does particle flow have to do with just finding two muons?
Nothing. It's just so that you keep the rest of the event. I mean, if you see the two muons.
Oh, that's what it means. Yeah. It's treated through the particle flow.
Alice, it wasn't entirely clear to me what Alice is doing because I guess there was less public information. Or I'm not sure what that was the right statement.
The dimuon is just not being used.
Well, I mean, just the whole scouting type story at Atlas was not as clear to me. And I got the impression that, it's in progress, but less is available at the moment. One thing which I hadn't appreciated is that the level 1 topological trigger is an important part of this because the HT trigger at Atlas is going over a wider eta range than the HT trigger at CMS, and therefore the HT thresholds have to be higher, which then limits how well this works. So the advent of the topological trigger will help Atlas considerably, not only with this, but presumably with a bunch of other things where the HT trigger is a tool, such as VBF plus HT, where VBF triggering where the HT trigger is what gets you on a level 1. So, is this true?
Yeah, we need it.
What's
supposed to have it? Is there a problem? No, you can turn the cameras off.
Okay. It, commissioning phase, I guess.
Yes, it's being commissioned. They're making good progress. Should be available.
Standard t-shirt.
Senator, can you speak directly to your chair, please?
So obviously, application number 1 that was talked about a lot, and also there was some discussion with the precision group, about a precision workshop about how what we understand these things is dijets. But specifically for scouting, the interesting thing is to go looking for dijet resonances down at low enough mass that you're sensitive to what in heck is going on at 750 GeV. And one point which was made is that at least in the previous run, 750 GeV is within reach, but it's also dangerously close to the turn-on curve because the HT cut is low enough that there's some you don't have a good sideband analysis as you'd like. So now you know, obviously efforts are being made, given the importance of this, to push the thresholds down. But I did just want to point out, it's an obvious point, but it's worth noting that, you know, here we have, we're dealing with a two-dimensional distribution when we're looking for a diget resonance, right? There's HT on this axis, there's diget mass on this axis, and our signal, which has a definite mass, some distribution in HT, but in particular there's a tail which is generated by ISR. And so you can always move away from the turn-on curve at the price of statistics. And so there's an interesting question about how to play that. And clearly that should be thought about in terms of how to maximize the limit the systematic error as much as possible.
Yeah, that's actually really good, because one of the, we do the fit inclusively, but one thing that wouldn't be very difficult to do would be to sort of bin it up, you know, perhaps into sort of an ISR tail region where you have a better turn on, and then the lower part, and then try to do seven tastes in the background.
I think that would help some. And that's true, even if you improve your turn-on curve and it moves down, you're still losing some signal here, you still probably get some
that's right.
advantage from that.
You're thinking ISR jet, there's also photon.
Yeah, I mean, but then the statistics, if we're talking about trying to find that seven...
Then you don't have to figure out which jet is...
Oh...
Yeah, but with the parking, we don't see that. Sorry, with the scouting, we don't see that.
Right, but it's in your real data.
No, with the scouting, it's part of the flow, so we would have... You'd be able to do the ID, but at some level it doesn't matter, right? You would just put a cut on something like the delta cut, some PT over H, some PT over mass.
No, what I was saying is the photon.
Yeah, no, but you don't care what the ISR kick is.
But I think, I mean, yeah. Specifically for the 750 GeV guy, I would say this is not the way to go, because two reasons. The first is, you're dealing with such low statistics, the price you pay for the photon is too high. You won't get much.
Well, if it's gluon-induced, you
won't. And if it's gluon-induced, you don't get initial state radiation, and...
But even just considering two bins where you have one that's semi-boosted and one that's not boosted.
Yeah. I think that's what... I think you should seriously consider that.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
There's even the possibility, I didn't think about this until just this moment, but if this new object, assuming it's real, is sometimes produced in the decay of something else, you'll have a couple of events way out here, and that could be powerful. So even a third bin might be useful. Okay.
Wait, sorry, what was the bin? Not the third bin, else.
So there's an ISR tail, but there's also the possibility of a tail of events that produce this object in the decay of something else, and therefore are significantly higher HT. Now, you could also pick those out by saying, well, you know, they may just have jets, but you don't necessarily know what. The one thing you know for sure is that the ST or the HT would be bigger in those events. So there might even be, you know, one or two events here whose weight should be larger. Oops, let's go back one.
It would be larger because...
Well, in the sense that the... No, it's larger in the... larger in the sense that your backgrounds are falling. Yeah. So if you've been in... If you think of this as a two-dimensional distribution, out here there's less background.
Yeah, it's... Okay, so it's the spirit of having multiple signal regions with different signal to background.
And the last thing I wanted to say about that, and we discussed it briefly, we didn't push it very hard, is, and it was partly, I couldn't really remember what the issues were that came up, but there was discussion about other numbers of jets, pairs of dijets, of course, pairs of trijets, which have been done, but I think there was also something else.
One thing that we wanted to wait for Eva.
Yeah, what was that?
One of the things that came up was the possibility of doing something like, you know, dijet resonance that's recoiling against a jet. And then there's some interplay between, you know, obviously the harder the PT, you can get above, you know, all the trigger thresholds, but you can reduce the PT threshold with the scouting, and then maybe go into semi-boosted regime, and there's some interplay between, you know, your rate versus,
it is this,
that we were considering was sort of a jet resonance recoiling against a jet.
Right, so out, if you go far enough out here, the jets start to emerge. Right, you get fat jet regime. So there's maybe even So we were all really talking about, I now remember, it was really all about the same thing.
But the question is, the question is numerically, would the scouting help in a particular region?
That would have to be
done. Back to the use case slide, previous one. What's the use case from the Muon?
Dimuons. The most obvious use case was the dark photons going to dimuons, but some people have been thinking about going after Higgsinos. That's a little bit pie in the sky, but that would be another possible use case.
I mean, I think it's important to state as parked, right? So you don't have to worry as much in this particular case of making sure you got everything you could possibly want online. So the question is, what are the things you could look for in those two muons that could make you go back and repurpose?
So there's this minimum mass of 10 GeV, right? So the dark photon case is really a much lower.
We're going to try and go lower.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
we want to go lower and go all the way down to.
Is there any limitation to how close the two muons
are? There is, in terms of the reconstruction. You get screwed up when the muons are too close.
Online, or this is an offline?
Online and offline.
You know what the delta R is? Where
that gets? No, I can't tell you, but it's just at some point the muon reconstruction just fails you for true level 3.
I will say though, I mean, it is still interesting between 10 GeV and the Z mass to look for resonances. I mean, so there have been some proposals they recast to some Jolyon spectrum to do this, but yeah. I mean,
but the low mass is also particularly
interesting. Yeah, of course.
Be neglected.
Yeah, I mean, Bell and Babar have covered at some level the low mass region, but there's no reason why, in principle, I mean, maybe the production mechanism different. And
Then Bell and Babar would have no limit.
Sure. But at 10 GeV, you definitely don't have any defect.
That's right.
The reason I brought it up, of course, is the scouting, the best use case, of course, has been digests. It's been a great success. But we're focused on just using jets for the scouting as a result. And it's such a powerful thing. You should be able to use it for all sorts of stuff. So.
Well, we in the next slide, I'll show you a couple of ideas that came up during this conversation.
I should just say, which people might not know, is that digests were an obvious use case, but we had trouble filling out the bandwidth for the rep with what we should do.
Yeah, I know.
People just didn't have ideas of things.
I know.
But I mean, the idea that I thought was really important, and I spent some time working on it, was the VBF plus effort.
Yeah.
And that there, I think the use case is very clear.
Yeah.
But that's not a scouting conversation, that's a parking conversation.
Yeah.
Except that maybe it should be a scouting conversation, which is also why it will come up now in a slide. But yeah, VBF plus anything is an example of something it's hard to get at because the trigger thresholds are low and it's you don't have high PT objects and so forth. But I think we should come back to your question because I think it would be important to fill that out a little bit more. A couple of things I'm going to cover right now will address that directly. Okay, so what JP emphasized to us early in the process was that scouting is great for looking at bump hunts at low mass, and by low mass it means low compared to what you usually need. And that includes very low if you're talking about leptons or photons. So whereas by contrast the net resolution is not good, so you're not going to want to talk about that very much. And if you're doing a sideband analysis, you don't have the problem of trying to convince your colleagues you don't understand your background at the level that you were in yourself that you don't understand it, at the level that you would for many other searches. Trying to find a smooth excess would be much, much, much harder. But so therefore, if you can think of places where you can do a bump hunt, but in a region that's hard to trigger, that's a definite use case. So we came up with a couple. And an example would be exotic K2K to some crap, which includes a dark, a light particle, a particle low mass, which is going to two leptons or two photons, or perhaps an edge as opposed to a bump. So some sort of kinematic feature. So an example would be you trigger on VBF inclusively, or you trigger on VBF plus one lepton. But then you look for pairs of leptons at the next level, and if you see them, you save it as scouted. And then you look for an invariant mass peak in those lepton pairs. Now, you can do the same thing for photon pairs. It's true that for lepton pairs, you already have your dimuon, so maybe you don't need to do this as a separate pathway. You just use the dimuon pathway. So here's a use case for the dimuons. Maybe you want to add something like this for the diphoton. So there was some question about whether there are technical issues with relatively low PT photons in scouting. We're distinguishing from, you know, the usual distinction of the usual fake rates might be higher and so forth. So that's something which we didn't get into in too much detail. But anyway, a use case for that would be you produce the Higgs decays to a couple of neutralinos or something like them, a couple of singlet particles, and one of them spits off, or both of them spit off, pseudoscalars. And one of those pseudoscalars goes to a pair of photons. And the other, let's say, goes to just hadrons. Not so useful. Or similarly, a dark photon gets kicked off, and you know, one of them gives you jets, and it gives you hadrons, but the other gives you a lepton pair. So that seemed to be an idea for which nobody had any objection, and there was nobody could think of an obvious reason not to do it. So I think that's a real one. And it doesn't have to go through VBF. You could be talking about Higgs, you could be talking about dark matter, you could bring something else, you could trigger on a jet plus MET, or jet plus MET and a lepton, or something, at level one, and clean that up and scout, and then look for a second lepton or two photons or something as a reason to keep it as scouted, and then look for the resonance.
And that's because the single photon PT threshold is very high in right. The standard trigger, right?
Right, thanks. I should have said that. Probably should have said that.
What did you say, 90 GeV or something, I guess?
Higher. Single photons,
160.
170.
For CMS, it's higher than for Atlas, for whatever. I don't know if it's choice or necessity, but in any case, this is an opportunity to keep photons you couldn't possibly keep some other way. And even find something interesting going on in a pair of light of low PT photons. So
that may be worth writing because this is a huge gap, right?
Yeah. So I think you could argue that for the leptons, you've already got your dimuon thing. This is just a matter of using it already. But for the photons, because of the PT threshold, even if you have two photons, the PT threshold is relatively high compared to what you might be looking for here. There's definitely some room. And there'll be interesting questions about how to treat the situation when the photons are coming close together. But this is all for the scouting people themselves to figure out. So but again,
comment, if you didn't see anything here, it's hard to use this scouted data to set limits on something because you don't understand your object efficiencies that well. If you see something, great, but if you don't, it's pretty hard to.
For jets, if you're doing a bump up kind of thing, you understand the correction.
Yeah, you know what your jet efficiency is.
So that's a bit more believable, but if you have leptons.
So the way we handle even the jets, because we have, there's still a mismatch between the online and the offline, say, jet energy corrections,
sure.
Is we actually have monitoring paths where we actually take the same data, it's pre-scale, you take the same data online, you re-recode it offline, and then you can do event-by-event comparison of the same jets and then say, okay, as a function of PT, as a function of eta, how does the mismatch look?
Right,
you can do the same thing with the leptons. You can do your tag and probe with your Z, ZDE, you can do the same kind of backflips you do with photons, and try to do that. So it's work. You have to think through. You don't want to come to the end of the run and discover, oh yeah, I guess I should have taken the trigger. But in principle, that can be done.
Okay. So now, since you had made this nice counter argument before, now you have to add pre-scale triggers to the analysis just for the reason that somebody's going to want to do an analysis, publish something based on.
That's right. Yeah.
So from the point of view of the management of the experiment, the idea that was a clear winner was scouting for the purposes of finding things.
Sure.
I'm significantly less convinced that it's a great idea to try to do the trigger level analysis. I'm open to some cases where, like digests, where it seems to be silly not to. You have the information, it's more or less what you need. But I think it's a dubious practice to consider expanding.
That's going to be the case for
us. You know,
that's what we're discussing here. That's why we're discussing it here.
I don't see a good way to go. There are physics that I don't see a good way to go after any other way.
I mean, this is certainly a case where I don't
know. You mean limits that you can set?
No, there's a sliver. Who knows? I mean,
there's no question if you see something, as Andy said, right?
You have to motivate the person to go and look in a serious
way. Motivation is not just the motivating the people is not as important, I think, as the science. Right? Let's start with science, right? The science reason. I mean, let's put it this way: if the statement was, "You don't know your efficiencies very well, but you know them. You're confident you know them to at least 30%," you still get a limit.
Sure.
May not be as good a limit as you would get, but since there may currently be no limit, you're still generating knowledge.
And in the converse situation, which was what it was really intended for, that you see a signal, you're going to want to have the full event information so that what you write about it is the best possible statement on it.
I agree. So
there's no reason that you don't go down that path if you see something.
If
you don't see something, then you're talking about a limit where if it's good to 30%, that's fine.
It would take a lot of work to prove that you know it.
As long as you don't have to devote a whole nother chunk of bandwidth to.
You know, a heavily prescaled Z trigger that you can use to monitor, I don't think it's
for that analysis. Then for the other analysis that wants to do, because those guys are doing scouting, it's got knock-on effects. Your trigger manager starts to get clouded with a lot of things that
they've already got diversion in, right? Yeah. So. You can ask, okay, how can you use the dimuon one effectively and learn how to do that? And then this diphoton one, I think for all discussion we had here, in the end, it's really about can you do something kinematically interesting with the paraphotons? And that is now a well-defined exercise that you can ask. How hard is that? Is someone taking notes? Because I realize with Katarina not here and with me up here speaking...
Yeah. Well, it's being recorded, right?
It's true.
Is
it because we never saw a student?
Well, we did. I'm wearing the mic. But nevertheless, I think a couple of interesting points have been made. It'd be a shame to lose them.
I'm
taking big level notes.
Big picture notes is fine. We just don't want to... Yeah.
I've got VBF plus 12 on down.
Okay, so here are some other ideas that came up in terms of things that you could consider adding to scouting. None of these is as clear, but might be worth thinking about. So inclusive VBF again came up, and the question is, well, if you did semi-inclusive VBF, what would you add to the VBF part? And again, for those who haven't thought about this, you get out of level one with an HG trigger, because even though the VBF jets are soft, hopefully you're making a Higgs or something like that, and so you get some net or you get some energy out. And if your HT trigger is powerful enough, you can just barely get out of level one, that's enough. And then at level two, you can start doing some obvious, looking at more details. So the question of whether you would get anything out of scouting is, I think, not entirely clear. But worth some thought. We've already talked about the fact that the photon threshold in the standard trigger is very high, and therefore you could ask, can you get something by lowering the photon threshold other than what we just discussed? And one example, there might be some standard model type, there might be a standard model application or two. Multiple parton scattering studies, for instance, where you might often look for a gamma jet from one parton scattering and a jet from a second parton scattering, the same proton-proton collision. And these are studies which are done, and maybe with a lower photon threshold you could get more events. On the other hand, maybe it's not so useful because there's so many events already. Pre-scale trigger is fine. So this is a quantitative question, and somebody has to talk to experts to figure out what they need and to decide whether you'd gain anything. But at least it's interesting to realize that there might be some other standard model applications which are out there. A completely different type of thing was rare decays of W, for example, to gamma plus a charged pion. This is a, I guess, some sort of scare model test. I don't know anything about it. Scott suggested it, and it's certainly true. It would fall by the wayside if you didn't have some trigger like this. And of course, you'd have to design scouting specifically to do this, because you need to pick out that isolated pion. Third example that came up is a rare decay of a Z to a photon plus a pseudoscalar, where the pseudoscalar goes to, well, if it goes to muons, you're going to pick it up already. But if it goes to Bs or something, you need that gamma to get the thing on tape. So that's an example of something that might be interesting.
Are also these Higgs to gamma J psi, are these already included?
We talked about that. So the thing about Higgs to gamma J psi is that there's nothing stopping you from having a gamma J psi trigger in the standard trigger menu. So that doesn't mean it exists. Have people talked about this?
Yeah, there is one in Atlas.
Yeah, I would guess we have one too, but I don't know.
Anything is.
Yeah.
It's not really, because every, you know, all the masses.
You've got VOI, so it's
fine. It's not covered by the Daniell trigger.
There's a special one to deal with prescales for the Daniell trigger to make sure that we get events that are covered there. So the differential rate is small. The more interesting one is gamma 5. Right, and that actually comes in on the tau trigger of all things.
Oh.
So anyway, there are some specialized decays like this. I think for Annie, you're the expert. Z goes to 3 photons will come in for your trigger without a problem.
Well, our rates are 20, our thresholds are 20, 20, 15 now, I think. Not really.
Well, so could scouting help you? I mean, you've got, even if you don't know your photons
your
that well, you've got
3 photons. It's under 3 photons.
It's the same issue. You would have trouble putting a good solid error bar on an observation or lack of observation.
If you really wanted to go after Z to 3 photons.
Okay. So add that to the list. I'll put it on. We'll make sure it goes on here.
Just to give a sense of scale for at least the gamma pi mode, at 30 interceptor bars, you'd expect something like 10 events.
So if Annie thinks that Z to 3 gamma might actually be worth doing, then Higgs to 4 gamma also comes on that list. You just pick up some more events. I mean, you can't hurt. That's the idea here, again, is that because although scouting doesn't have great particle ID relative, and you don't understand it as well as you might, it has good resolution. So when you have a known mass peak, like the Z or the Higgs, you can at least collect those events and events nearby. Okay, so we'll add that. Okay, then we had a substantial amount of discussion on other things. So anything more on scouting?
No, look to FTK. Okay. I was thinking out loud. Photon, the seed threshold was raised in CLS for run 2. Do you know what it is? Also, the spike killing, all that was put into the level 1 firmware. How much do you trust a seed trigger level gamma in CMS? So the previous slide, you said something about
need to talk to
experts. So. So I think that's certainly true. You need to talk to the experts, Alexander Sapi, for example, and ask him what's really possible. Anyway, neither here nor there.
Right, so I think the big picture is a lot of discussion was about photons.
Yeah.
And some about VBM. And that's really
where we ended up.
A lot of subtopics. Okay, so currently, just to remind you, Atlas can run high quality tracking if they get out of level 1 only for level 1 regions of interest, which is a significant limitation. They can't look at the whole detector. CMS can look at the whole detector, but it takes some time. And FTK sort of leapfrogs that a little bit by providing at the end of every level one accept, immediately after accepting an event at level one, the full tracking information with some pretty good resolution will be available.
Yeah, I mean, it's trigger list dependent. You can find a region of interest to be the whole detector for a certain L1 trigger if you want.
Fair enough. On the other hand, now every event that passes level one, so we the important thing is to understand that that's now, even that's bypassed now. So that,
is that really true? I mean, if you define your region of interest to be the whole detector?
Yeah, you can do a full scan in FTK if you want to.
But it doesn't take too long in the trigger?
Well, you can't do it for every event, yeah. But for a certain L1.
So, but that's he was making a distinction between
that's the whole
now
of the region of interest.
Before I do now.
As opposed to what will be possible next.
So the full detector is available
only after FTK, right? Well, now there is no FTK.
Right, so you can't do the full detector. Right. So you can only do regions of interest.
Well, at level 2, you can do the full detector if you want to. Again, for a limited right?
So the improvement is that now it's possible for almost, sort of for free. It doesn't take extra time, and it's available on every event, so you have more choices.
It's not. No, you can't do it at every event at level 2. So.
With FTK, it becomes possible. It's available for every event, if I understand correctly. It doesn't mean you can have time to use it for every event, right. But it is sitting there. And it doesn't take extra time.
You have to read the information out for two very big events and write it back to back.
Not sure. It's probably a dead time or something. I don't think the readout is the issue of any buffer, but. It's a lot of data about the full process. Too much of the processing.
Right. But the point is, you can have triggered on a jet over here and take a look to see if some funny tracking is happening over there, and that would not have been possible with the current arrangement. Not that it would be easy for CMS to do that either. So the really important thing is that this information is now, that the time used for tracking has already taken place during level one. While level one was deciding what to do, some other piece of machine was doing the tracking for you. And it's there ready to go if you want it. And so it's more information and it's faster information. And it's more flexible. So the question is, how do you exploit that?
But is it the whole detector? Or is there some to make a decision? Yeah. How is the decision on the region of interest made? Because you've got to combine information from other parts of the detector to do that. Is it around the jet, opposite the jet?
I'm confused. You're confusing me. FTK is taking, correct me if I'm wrong, it's taking information from the pixels, shipping it out into a box, which then does the processing with these pre-programmed pattern finders, and then ships it over to the trigger crate, which is also going to get the L1 accept, if L1 accepts it.
That's what we thought. Before any guy.
It's a little more complicated. I mean, level 2 has to ask for the tracking information. It won't by default just get all of the tracks from the full event. That would be too much readout. So what level 2 says, I have something that I care about knowing about, then it will go and ask FTK for those tracks from that region of interest. So it's simple, the tracks were actually found for the full event. So it's somewhere in between.
Okay, so you see it has to be a level 2 accept almost, or at least a signature being evaluated.
It's a level 1 accept, but level 2 has to request information from
the FTK. So then it's readout or data transfer. The tracking, the pattern recognition is done by the associative memory in real time all the time.
Right. And you don't have time to decide and wait whether I'm going to start looking.
So you're just basically asking for a region. If the whole region, then it would take more time, but you could do that occasionally.
Right.
But not a lot.
Right.
And the thing of it is, it takes time to read out the FTK.
Right. It's a lot of data.
Right. So that introduces some subtleties that I don't think we've fully processed, but that leaves to see if anything I've said here needs to change. Obviously, those theorists who like to think about lone look particles and the experimentalists too are curious about such a thing in terms of how displaced tracks can be can be handled here. And because FTK is a pre-programmed pattern recognition system, it's got to be really, really fast. It's not designed, it can't be designed to find tracks that have a displacement of the center. So, which doesn't say it has no efficiency for that at all, but it's low. And basically, it's got good efficiency out to 2 millimeters, and then it drops off, and it's certainly not going to find highly displaced tracks. That's not what it's for. But it's really good for bees, or for other particles whose lifetime is comparable to bees.
This 2 millimeters was impact parameter, right?
Impact parameter, yeah, IP efficiency.
The bean stuff.
So, what else is it good for? Well, I guess the I don't know why this is offline. Just to decrease threshold. This is a mix of my notes and Katerina's, and I might have failed to notice that this word offline is here. I think it should be online. The extra track information obviously can remove backgrounds of various sorts, and allowing decreased thresholds. And for scouting. The fact that there's more information about tracks already calculated means that decisions can be made in a different order. You can just ask about the tracks rather than waiting for them to be calculated. So it makes it easier to scout low PT, BJETs, TAUs, maybe even MET, although we had some discussion about MET being not so good at scouting in general, but maybe FTK improves it. That wasn't entirely clear on the implication. In any case, various object improvements are possible at the trigger level, including pilot projection, jet resolution, missing ET, finding and counting isolated tracks and displacement. So that's the machine that's going to be available. And the question is, what are the applications? And we discussed a few possible ones. Probably most of them are already, the plans to implement them are presumably already in place now. So I'm not sure how much new we said. Obviously, you could run a tau trigger off isolated tracks rather than off of purely calorimetric information, or in a different order, essentially. You can select events just based on isolated tracks, presumably. So this is a question. If level 2 says, deliver me all the isolated tracks, is that something FTK can do? Does that require a full readout of FTK in order to ask that question?
Probably, yeah. Right. So you couldn't do that at full rate.
FTK doesn't know about isolated tracks. It can give you a list of tracks, which then you can go through and say, is this So you've got a combinatoric issue there, which is going to take some serious time. In fact, if we take so much time, my guess is you're better off writing the event rather than screwing with it and dealing with it offline. Right. For example, CDF...
So what would you choose to... What would be the reason to make the decision to write?
Well, if it takes you
something else besides isolated track.
Yeah, if it takes you, I'm just thinking, if it takes you longer to determine if the track is isolated than it does to write out the event.
Yeah.
Right. If you remember the XFT at CDF, if there were more than 7 tracks, we didn't make any combinations. We just wrote it.
And for a similar reason, you can't ask FTK for tracks above a certain PT.
That you can do. You can also restrict it. You can restrict it in phi, so you can look at isolation in the sense of, I've got a calorimetric jet over here, do I have tracks pointing at it or away from it or 90 degrees or whatever? That you can ask, but if you start doing pairwise combinations, it's going to be slow.
But in particular, you could read out all the tracks with PT above 15 or 10 GV.
That's right.
And then if you find one such track that's isolated from all the other such tracks, you could then read out a region of phi around that track.
The problem is trying to figure out that it's isolated from all the other tracks.
No. If you read it, first question is it, you read out the stiff tracks, you ask if a particular stiff track is isolated from other stiff tracks. That's not such a big calculation because there's not so many tracks.
I'm not sure you can do multiple readouts per level 2 step the same. You flush everything.
Yes.
I don't actually know.
That's important. That's an important question.
That might be slower. Might be slower than just reading out the whole event.
I guess you could do it if you held the trigger. You could do that. But now your complex dead time is going to go up.
Right, you don't want to wait to get the event and then analyze it and then have dead time while you decide whether you're going to read it out.
So I think it's technically possible, but it's politically impossible.
Okay, well, this is important because these kinds of comments were not... this subtlety was not available to us.
I wouldn't worry about it too much. I didn't mean to alarm anyone. I think
some of the ideas we had just depended upon not thinking this way.
You just shouldn't assume that any of these triggers that you're interested in are going to run at 100 kilohertz. Maybe they'll run at 10. That's all.
Well, I think part of what we were trying to understand, so part of what I was trying to understand is, what are the kinds of logical questions you can ask that FTK makes possible that you would never have tried to ask before because you had to do the tracking afterwards. So I am actually trying to understand what the logic pathway is. Not because I'm getting discouraged, because I just want to make sure, you know, asking the right questions in the right order.
I don't think it buys you any qualitative difference. It buys you a quantitative increase in the rate of events that you can have full tracking for, or the rate of events that you can have region of interest tracking for. It increases both.
The real advantage is it cuts down the rate of our bread and butter triggers large enough that we can think about putting in oddball triggers into the menu.
I mean, backing up again, just to understand better where it's... When you say it cuts down the rate for standard triggers, I don't think we talked enough about about examples of that. So can you maybe give us one example?
So inclusive lockdowns and inclusive VLANs have rates which are essentially unsustainable at some point and heavily monopolize the LAC. We would like to keep those, and we would like to keep them as undamaged as possible. So keep the thresholds low, keep the isolation reasonable, and so on. At the trigger level, saying I've got a good track is very helpful. Particularly when you say offline, I'm going to require a good track.
But I mean, normally you would ask that question at level 2 anyway, right? If you had a photon an E gamma candidate at level 1, you would ask for a track in that vicinity also. But it would just take you longer.
Right. As you point out, I start the tracking before I even ask that question. So when it comes into level 2, you ask the FTK.
Well, see, that's, for example, the problems with muons and the problems with the momentum measure. Without a track, it's not, you mismeasure it by enough that the exponentially higher rate at the low for the lower PT muons is clogs everything.
I guess what I'm asking is, how much of level 2 does that question in today, when you ask, is there a track associated to this E gamma object, how much time are you using for that? Of the whole level 2 decision? Is that essentially the whole level? I mean, is that the majority?
I don't know.
It's pilot dependent, too. I think when pilot starts to go up, it gets worse and worse. So that's part of the issue. I don't think it's sustainable without FDK. So it's pilot.
I see. So part of this is associating the tracks to the right vertices?
No, just finding the tracks.
With more
powers of occupation?
Yeah.
Isn't it the same? You have the same fundamental problem that we have?
Yes.
That it's if you don't have a track, you don't really have a good measurement of the momentum.
So what drives our muon rates? I mean, Stefan knows better, but essentially you've got a low PT muon that has a straight hit on the track at the trigger level, which you then say, this looks like it could be a high PT muon, and I don't have the time to determine that. So it's a 5 GeV track, which you think is 50. Well, if you then go and the central tracker tells you it's a 5 GeV track, you're done.
The level 1 U1 momentum resolution is very poor.
Yeah.
That's our problem. So we solve that by using
1 centimeter resolution.
So in other words, so what you're really saying is the level of rapid rejection is much easier to make a rapid rejection of. Which then opens up time for
it's
the
much easier to make a rapid rejection because you have better information, more precise information.
Right. And you have it right at the start of level 2 without having to do anything else.
Right. The trigger really, its decision is no versus maybe. And being able to move things out of the maybe category into no is a big help.
Greater accuracy.
Yeah.
It's a big deal because it's such a big deal.
Okay. All right. So anyway, here's a list of things that we discussed. We discussed what you might be able to do with isolated tracks, what you might be able to do with displaced tracks, what you might be able to do with jets that have no tracks, although as we've already discussed, there's a pileup issue, which I don't think I certainly fully understand. In particular, for example, if you were able to say, okay, I have two trackless jets in the event, right at the very beginning of level two, you would, in principle, then be able to turn around and say, well, maybe I have time to do some outside-in tracking here, which you normally wouldn't have had time for, maybe. But more generally, using trackless jets from FTK as a seat for some sort of long-lived particle trigger pathway or some parking or some sort might be useful. VBF, I don't know how we discussed this, that after a level one HT trigger and along the way to VBF, you have two VBF jet candidates. It's presumably helpful that you can know right away which vertex the most central VBF jet, assuming it's in the tracker, actually came from. And you know that right away without having to do any additional tracking. This is potentially useful if you're looking for VBF plus something and you have that something as well. You want to check, but does something in this jet come from the same place? Because if they don't, what's the point? And he's looking very thoughtful, so I'm waiting for his comment.
Yeah, I don't think we do that. I don't think we trust the vertex assignment that much to base a trigger off of two things that come from the same vertex. I am trying to think of a good answer why we don't do that.
Yeah, why not?
I think it's paranoia.
Yeah, I think it's paranoia, right? And part of the calibrate, maybe.
Well, if I have VBF plus a muon that's not hard enough to fire the single muon,
and I don't think you gain that much rejection either. I don't think there would be that much.
Really? With a VBF? I mean, VBF jets?
Not often you would get a VBF jet, VBF-looking like jet, and a big PT jet from a different vertex. So I don't think the background for that is perfect. So, you know, you might throw out 10% of your signal and maybe only reduce the read by, 20%, so it's just not.
That's probably not true.
I'm a little surprised.
Yeah, it could.
I mean, VBF jets are, you know.
But it also gets harder to figure out which first place is yours. Yeah.
I think also looking in the future, you know, vertexing is not as going to be as valuable as it is today because we're going to the omni-vertex, right? Everything is coming from a bright, luminous region. What vertexing tells you is tracks that I'm not interested in give me a better Z information than the tracks that I was interested in. And if there are 200 vertices, it doesn't happen anymore. So there's not a whole, you know, anyone, let's talk, I'm going to channel JP here. The sociology of this is such that it's hard to get people excited to work on what's clearly going to be a temporary solution.
Okay, I have to think about it.
Sorry, that. I just had to.
You're talking about trigger.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Offline is still not
a big thing. Offline is a different story.
Okay, I mean, interesting. All right, and the other thing we talked about was whether you can use FTK to help you find high DEDX track stubs or tracks. And this is another one which, you know, wasn't clear to us. Jet plus meta at level one, use...
get that information? Sorry, you get DEDX information in FTK?
Yes.
Oh, that's cool. Yes.
Ah, so that was a question whether you actually FTK had it. So you could ask for all the high DEDX track stubs?
Now, can you... Well, again, you have to ask several of that. That is not separated out.
That's okay.
But for each
track, you could ask for any stiff track, any track with PT above 30, and very quickly loop through them to see if you have high DEDX.
Yes.
So that actually works, well, and you could do that with scouting.
Great. Yeah. So we can do that at level two. Now again, it's just a matter of
you can do it faster and therefore with a lower jet plus met threshold,
right.
And you can scout because you really don't. All you care about is you got the track stops, so you can just save them. So you can really push the thresholds down quite a long ways, perhaps.
You may not even need to scout.
And maybe you don't.
If the rate's low enough, you can trigger your sphere. I mean, I don't know, because you only, how many layers do you have in FPK? There's, or like the silicon, it's like four or five.
That'll
layers.
Be four.
Yeah, so that might not be enough to bring the rates down. So you may have to go to scouting.
Well, in any case, you know, there's the standard degenerate charge unit neutralino case. There's the also a new charge particle with decays in flight. And, you know, term makes a vertex, but for whatever reason, so hard, you know, maybe the vertex is mostly met and soft stuff, as it is in this case. So your track stone is useful there, too.
Can I ask my CMS colleagues, is there a reason why we don't have a DDX trigger?
Did.
I don't think we did. We not. I have never seen one.
So
I don't know if I don't know if it was. If,
really was
if it was, there was an obvious reason that we didn't have one, or if I was just too stupid to ask why we didn't have one. Or I just been too stupid.
I thought Loic and company looked into this, and I thought it happened.
We definitely don't have it. So either they looked into it, couldn't do it, or.
I don't know what the reason is.
I think your colleague Yuri might know the answer to that one.
I'm as likely as anyone to know the answer to that one.
Yeah. That's true.
Definitely looked into it.
All right, so I think of this list of ideas, the one which, this is the one that we didn't, this is one we didn't kill. by better understanding, and this one might actually work. So those are probably worth keeping in mind. Okay, my last couple slides were on the things we discussed yesterday, namely the hard-soft analysis and the triggering and substructure. I'm not inclined to go through this very in much detail because essentially everybody was here. So, but I can maybe put the slides up, and if people want to ask questions or follow-up comments, just to remind you, the hard-soft analysis was an issue of what happens if you've got you produce a pair of particles, they're bound together, and therefore the first thing that happens is they radiate lots of soft energy, and then the second thing that happens is they annihilate and produce a pair of something. And so, and because they annihilate at the ground state, they're almost always doing so about the same energy, and therefore you get a bump, but it's in events that have special characteristic, namely there's a lot of photons, there's a lot of tracks, there's a lot of light, the small, low PT jets, and so forth. So the question is, you know, what are the strategies? And one important point is, how do you approach the question of you know, do you demand the soft stuff first and then look for the bump? Do you demand the bump first and look for the soft stuff? Or is there something in between? How do you think about your backgrounds? What data-driven techniques do you want? And importantly, let's not forget, this might actually be the case for the 750 GeV resonance that we're seeing, so this is actually somewhat urgent. And one question I think which came up was whether FTK was useful in this.
Did we have a conclusion about what sample you could select that had similar Q-squared of the hard interaction
right.
that would not have the clutter associated with it if this process was real?
It's a sideband.
Oh, I see. Yeah. This is. So what you're asking is.
Okay. All right. So if it's just a bump.
But if you want to be sure, if this is a neutral particle going to two photons, it can't go to lepton plus mat. So that's a sample. Granted, that's not a resonant sample, but okay, it's still what you could do. So you have that. You also have the hypothesis that. This thing is not decaying to a pair of electrons. It might not be correct, but it's still true you can do a sideband analysis there. So if you do your sideband analysis on E plus E minus, you'll see nothing. That then is a suitable background measurement for what should happen in DiGAP. I think you have enough tools between this one, which you can't possibly contribute to. You could argue maybe there's a charged particle that has the same mass and will contribute to this, but the net washes it out anyway. So you never see one. So this has got to be safe. And there's plenty of events. Then there was the question about signal Monte Carlo, and that's, of course, a serious one. And if we want to discuss this further, that's really, I mean, if someone wants to be serious about looking for the 750 GeV thing and put a limit, we better come up with a Monte Carlo method now.
Yeah, that has to happen before we could get serious about doing this. I mean, okay, CMS might come up with some toy model and generate something. We might come up with something, but it would be chaos, and they both would probably be completely unrealistic, and it would be better if there was some...
Completely unrealistic theorist model. Yeah, I know, I agree. Brian, you haven't thought about these things.
I thought so.
Scott has. So between you, me, and Nathaniel, we should solve this problem at least to the level that they can do the search on the 750 GeV thing now. They need some Monte Carlo for if the 750 GeV thing is quirks as quirks.
I don't need to agree.
I don't think it is, so I'm not going to speak.
Yeah. And I also don't think it matters, because I mean it matters if you want to turn it into an analysis where you write a paper on what you didn't find. Yeah. What we're talking about is we have a potential signal and we want to know if there is diffuse energy around it.
Yeah.
And we should just look at it. If we both agree somehow that it's there,
then we can't publish a paper and I say, look, I wrote my own generator.
Right. But you only care about that when it's a limit.
Yeah.
There's no way the thing that they're going to dream up is what's actually there. if we had the excess and we turned that and then there was this stuff around it in those events, in peak, in 750, then it would be all of our job to figure out what that is.
Right. No, I'm not saying that we shouldn't go look until they finish writing their generator,
but
before we publish a paper. We have that.
There's a secondary issue. Okay, I agree. I mean, I'm very much of the opinion that
if we see a signal, then we'll figure it out.
Then we even more have to work together with the two.
I'm sure they'll be interested.
It's not worth their time to write something now.
I agree they look first, discover first, worry about seeing Monte Carlo later approach. I'm totally okay with that. But there is a second order effect, which is that if the signal is diffuse in just the right way, it could actually mess up isolation, things like that. And without some type of Monte Carlo to model that, it's actually hard to know, right? I mean, some type of order one Monte Carlo that tells you that, this doesn't completely destroy your signal in some because of something that you didn't think about would actually be useful.
Well, but let's just...
So I think in this case, we could...
So you're going to throw radiation. At some rate, the rate that you throw radiation at is completely proportional to how bad it screws up your isolation. There's no physics that tells you what that rate should be.
But there's.
I could be a little more precise about that. There, for a particular hypothesis, and there's only a finite number of them, for what the particle, what the constituents of this object are, there is a certain production as a certain production rate as a function of the. Energy above threshold, and that's the energy which is coming back out again. So you add a hypothesis that how much of that energy comes out visibly, and you have to decide whether it's tracks or photons, pretty much. It could be a little more complicated than that, but you can start with that. And then you can ask, are you even close to the point where you lose a significant number of your photons due to isolation?
That's right.
So you could do that calculation. Really, it's not even a Monte Carlo calculation. It's essentially you do it semi-analytically. And we could do that. If you ask the question, how much energy is in a cone, you don't necessarily need to know that. All you need to know
why
is...
Why would it be a cone? Why wouldn't it
no,
be...
What I mean is, you have your hard photon with an energy of 300 GeV. There is some isolation requirement which involves some questions.
Well, no, I mean, it matters experimentally if you have 5 20 GeV photons in that region, or you have 1,000, 1.1 GeV.
Yeah, but if I could prove to you that it didn't matter in any case, no matter how many, there just wasn't enough energy, that no matter how it comes out, it won't screw it up. That would be sufficient.
So you're saying that's a systematic, we should
widely
varying PT spectrum and test that it doesn't screw things up in any case.
Well, I was going to say it more semi-analytically, which is you tell me how much energy you can afford in all the different situations, and let's see which one could possibly cause a problem. Having figured out which ones
could afford.
Well, the question is, if I've got a 300 GeV photon, can I allow electromagnetic energy of you know, 40 GeV in some cone of radius 0.2 or something. Okay, what is the isolation criterion that's actually used? Given that, I can then ask, what type of physics could possibly cause a problem? With that information, then we can try to decide, you know, do we need a Monte Carlo or do we need just a good physics argument?
I mean, also,
I think probably because there's so little we know, working backwards from asking could this ever be a problem? Maybe a more efficient way to go.
But if the radiation is diffuse enough, isn't there a chance that it would just be removed by pile-up subtraction? Because this would change the average, energy from the area subtraction, and so it's right. not so obvious that it would. Okay.
That was, I think, you made that point.
It's worse if it's pions and if it's photons.
But if it's a photon and you have a lot of other EM stuff around it, right, that you have a non-isolated photon.
Or it could muck around with your resolution. Make the peak wider.
Isn't what you should do just look in the peak and off the peak and maybe vary the isolation criteria if you're worried that somehow it's been...
Yeah, so what Chris is talking about is analysis with clutter. But what you guys seem to be also talking about is analysis of clutter, where the signal model is generating something that you need to analyze in the clutter, rather than just there being a lot of soft photons and something with a hard process.
Well,
so
I mean
in one case, you look for something hard and you make sure that what's around it is something sensible. In the other case, you care about what's around it and need the energy distribution of the photons, the shape of the photons in the case of the harmonic paper. You want to do some analysis on that clutter rather than just make sure it's...
Well,
you see what I'm saying? I mean,
yes, but it seems to me there's several different issues, which is maybe why it seems like it's a complicated conversation. It actually is. There's a question of establishing there's a bump. That's obviously a question number one.
Yeah.
Part of that question will be, do Atlas and CMS see the same thing?
Yeah,
and of course, if there's clutter and it's being dealt with differently through experiments, it might get very confusing. So I could see a wider peak. So even in comparing the experiments, this could be an issue. Then in convincing yourself that this bump is not an elementary particle after you've established it's there, the clutter can be a diagnostic. Or showing that it's not there can be a diagnosis. And the third possibility is you fail to find a bump because the clutter is there. And this seems unlikely, but should be checked that it doesn't somehow screw up.
There is a bump, right? So the fact is, if the clutter were doing that, you should, by removing it, it should go up.
Yes.
And so you check, you test it. If it does, then that's the strongest evidence yet that you're doing something. One of your suppression mechanisms is not optimal for this signal.
I think this is why they interplay, and of course the fourth thing you would do, having established that yes, the bump is there, and yes, the soft stuff is there, then you would analyze the soft stuff to see what exactly it is.
Sure.
And then that would be more precisely diagnosed.
So the definition of clutter is if it just extra tracks coming out of
or a lot.
Or the extra photons, extra soft stuff that's far below the hard interaction.
So that's easy enough to look at on and off.
Exactly.
Can't do it in real time.
Yeah, it's right. In the case of 750, you have something to look at, something to focus on. In the case of generic search for microscopic quirks, it's a bit harder, right?
What did you say?
Right here.
In the case of 750, you have something to focus on. You will definitely look around and understand it.
Right.
As a generic search for quirks, I'm trying to build a strategy for a generic search for quirks. It becomes a bit more difficult.
That's clearly more difficult. But the 750 is the urgent one. And so if we're talking about people putting time into it now, that's where the time's going to go. And that's where it should go.
We have a whole session or conversation about other things to look at for the 750 leak, Or you did?
We did in block one. But
oh,
we,
yeah.
We
could, so we could rehash it a little bit since you weren't here. It was pretty interesting. Okay.
We have notes on the wiki. You can look at it.
Okay.
Also, for 750, if it were real, which it's not, we don't have the issue of clutter destroying the isolation because we saw the bump first. Right. The clutter could not have destroyed the isolation.
Right. But it could have. So it's still worth looking.
Yes.
All of a sudden, this quirky stuff will become a lot more believable if you.
If I could cut away 90% of the background with a vertex multiplicity cut, that's.
Right. That would be very exciting.
But we don't have to worry about, is there so much clutter that it swamps
the quirky? So it's grinning ear to ear by the later of this week, even though we.
Can I get an acknowledgement?
The question is, which person's going to have the grin first? And how will it spread?
Is it useful to do with this with other objects, like Higgs or C or W, to look for this other stuff? I'm just trying to, because doing a completely general search seems difficult.
Yeah, so I don't know.
That's just a question.
I'm not sure I understand completely. Do you mean looking for events with Z plus X and then looking for clutter, or are you talking about?
Rather than look for clutter in general, abstract. Because we're talking about, okay, here's a specific thing, limit 750.
Right.
And you can look at all events with a Z, a W, a Higgs.
Well, remember, there was a hard scatter. Plus the clutter, right? So you could go after the hard scatter.
The discussion we had.
Yeah, or ISR or something.
Well, the discussion we had, I mean, mainly because it hasn't been done yet and you'd want to learn how to do it first, I would think the right thing to do, which doesn't mean you can't do what you just suggested, but I would think the first thing to do is learn how to do resonance searches in the presence of bumpers. Because that's one of the easiest places to study the backgrounds and learn, and also it's one of the easiest places to figure out that you've seen something or that you haven't because of the sidebands. And then once you learn how to do it, then you can probably do more general things.
But, well, Z and gamma are resonances.
Yeah. Do you mean like a Z gamma resonance, or do you mean?
No, I mean a Z is a resonance.
So that's his list there. Right?
Yeah, I see. You know.
Yeah.
But building up on this and then connecting it to what you were saying before in terms of the other channels that we look for to corroborate possible evidence of the diproton resonance, right? There is a Z-gamma resonance searches that we've done. So how would the clutter affect, like, where we don't see anything at 750, is that with the 2015 data, right?
Oh, I see. You're saying, even if the clutter is exactly the same, its effect on the objects
on the objects might be different, right? So I don't know, and would that be consistent with the lack of resonance in the Z-gamma channel, for example?
Well, I think in most of these models, it's completely consistent not to see Z gamma just because the quantum numbers.
Yeah.
You really see it now. But it's true. If clutter showed up, you'd have to rethink how that affects some of the other objects. Yeah. That's a good point. Okay, so anything else on this slide? The last slide is just figuring substructure. That was the last thing we did, so I think we need the least time.
We're pretty well over time as well. So.
You know, our point was to. Of course, we can quit any time. The point was, of course, to. All right, so just scan your eyes down this, and I think you'll see everything here is definitely discussed in detail.
And I guess if there's anything on this topic that we could revisit it in block six or whatever we want.
And then I also have one slide on things that we really didn't discuss, which I'll basically skip, but if you want to be reminded of what we didn't really make much progress on, it's here. Okay, and so that's the summary. and since we're done with block three, we can go on to block four.
That's probably the best way to start, right?
As a theorist.
Okay.
All right, thanks, Matt.
Thank you.